the question that was drawn out for this evening, you may or may not recall, but we will read it in just a moment, or I will read it in just a moment. This question about crowns of glory. The person said, "I have heard that the crown of glory is a special reward for faithful, obedient, God-called pastors. Is this a biblically sound statement, and how does it relate to other church members?" Interesting question. Not so sure that it relates any differently, but we'll talk about that some this evening. By the way, in case you don't know of other things, every now and then I run across some rather sardonic and sarcastic kinds of things. And a number of years ago, I bought this book, The Hereticus Papers, Volume 2 of the Collected Writings of St. Hereticus, edited by Robert McAfee Brown, who actually wrote them. It's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. For example, he includes six elegant proofs for the existence of Santa Claus. Adventurous advertising and biblical buttressing, a Christmas collation, and a lot of other things. But a couple of things that he includes in here, which are kind of funny and yet sometimes in some churches, maybe not so funny, under things churchy. Five ways to undermine the pastor, a real life story. Getting at the pastor through the pastor's spouse. And there's several ways to do that. I was telling Vicki the other day, some of them are kind of funny. I should have brought this into the budget meeting a while ago. The impact of innuendo and references. "I hope you don't mind my phoning you on your husband's day off. I know he said the two of you were going somewhere for the day. Isn't it your wedding anniversary? But my Jimmy's in the fifth grade play at 11:30 this morning. It means so much if he would come to..." But yes, Ralph told me they did talk at the vestry meeting. He's Episcopalian. He was writing predominantly for Episcopal Church. But they did talk at the vestry meeting about raising your husband's salary, but he's so spiritual they knew he would resent it if they dared to tempt him with things of the world. And some other things, too. They're kind of funny. I saw a book this summer when we were at CBF. I did not buy it. I hope I don't find it in any of your libraries if I visit your home. 365 Ways to Criticize the Pastor, one for every day of the year. I thought I'd start out with a little levity here, given that question. Recently, there was an article that appeared in one of the Baptist newspapers that perhaps this particular minister who wrote it, I know part of what he was saying is to challenge people to do more, but sometimes I wonder if this particular person also might be one of those who would think he was going to get a special crown of glory. He's talking about Acts chapter 2, verse 42, and how the church continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, fellowship, breaking of bread, prayers, and then they were continually daily in one accord in the temple. He said these were truly disciples and not dabblers. Now consider these statistics. These are modern-day statistics. 5 out of 100 church members cannot be found in the average church. 20 out of 100 church members admit they do not pray regularly. 25 out of 100 say they rarely, if ever, read the Bible except in church. 30 out of 100 never attend church. 40 out of 100 never give financially to the church. 50 out of every 100 never attend Sunday school. 60 out of 100 never come back on Sunday night. 70 out of 100 never give to support missions. 80 out of 100 never attend prayer meeting. 90 out of 100 do not have a family altar in their homes. And we really don't mean a literal altar, but they don't take the time to do that. And 90 out of 100 do not attempt to lead people to faith in Jesus. those things are not things that vocational ministers are called to do. Those things are things that we're all called to do as Christians. And it is in that kind of situation, when we are called to do those things and we do them, that we indeed, according to the biblical text, are able to look forward to a time where we receive our rewards for doing such. Although, quite frankly, sometimes I think that we place too much emphasis on receiving rewards for things that we do, rather than talking about, this is an aside, not in my notes, I know that surprises you, rather than talking about the fact that we should do these things not to get reward, but because of what we have already received. The opportunity for redemption through Jesus. And yet, how many times do we hear folks say, you know, they did such and such, they're just going to get another star in their crown. Or, I have had folks, by the way, to say, you talk about, not in this church, I promise you, not in this church, but I've had folks in other churches to say in my presence, or one person even said to me, I said something one day about how much they did, and they said, well, you know, I'm just trying to get a bigger mansion in heaven. No, excuse me, they didn't even say heaven, they said, I'm just trying to get a bigger mansion in glory. That's how they said it too. I'm trying to get a bigger mansion in glory. I thought, now, yeah, James does say that that faith without works is dead. And some people think, oh, he says you can work your way to heaven. He doesn't. What he says is, if you truly have that faith and if you truly have that belief and it is a part of who you are, then you can't help but do those things. And it's not to get a bigger mansion or extra stars. It's because you have been given that opportunity to be redeemed to begin with. And yet, we oftentimes tell folks, if you will but do such and such, then you will get greater rewards in heaven. Do we not? So, what does the Bible say about those crowns, and not the ones in your mouth? In fact, you might wish that you get some free crowns for all that you do. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul is talking about being an apostle. And some Bibles talk about and label chapter 9 as rites of an apostle, as Paul emphasizes that he has not exercised certain rights that are his because he is an apostle. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, starting in verse 24, he writes, "Do you not know that in a race the runners all compete, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win it. Athletes exercise self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, that is a crown, but we an imperishable one. So I do not run aimlessly, nor do I box as though beating the air, but I punish my body and enslave it so that after proclaiming to others, I myself should not be disqualified." So he's talking here about running a race and competing and trying to win a crown. There are those who would say that is what we are trying to get to, is that crown that is imperishable, because people compete all the time for other crowns and other rewards. I mean, we loved to get ribbons. We loved to get trophies. When I played football and basketball and baseball and ran track, some of those were more individualistic than others. And we would brag about those things and have a certain swagger. But what Paul is talking about here is not for, I don't think, is for us to say, okay, the only reason we do these things is to get this special crown. But rather, if we persevere to the end of the race, using his analogy, that is, if we persevere to the end of our lives as Christians, giving up ourselves. He said, I punish my body for others so that I might not be disqualified at the end. Then we don't have to worry about our reward with God, because we're going to get the same thing that everybody else that perseveres as Christians get. To be in the presence of God forever. And to enjoy that presence of God forever. It's not about having a bigger house on the hill. It's about being there together with God and others who have persevered as Christians unto the end. Now, I said a few moments ago, the rights of an apostle, and there are people. Paul did say, you know, I haven't exercised certain rights that are mine as an apostle. So we have to admit, there was a little bit of that that crept into some of what Paul said earlier in the chapter. We didn't read it. He's on the defensive, by the way. He didn't always get along with the Corinthian Christians. But what are the rights of an apostle? The same rights that you have. Because guess what? You're apostles. A disciple is a learner. We become Christians and we are learners. We are disciples. An apostle is somebody sent with a message. And guess what? Every one of us has been instructed that when we receive Christ, we are also to share that message. We are to tell. It's not an office of an apostle. It is a function as an apostle. You know, we talk oftentimes around deacon elections how deacon is not an office in the New Testament. Deacon is a function. A function of service. It's the same thing with an apostle. While as the church developed, there was a hierarchy that developed, and unfortunately some of those folks at different times took that as meaning they had certain rights and privileges that nobody else was going to have. That was not the purpose of apostleship. The purpose of apostleship was that you might lead by example in serving others. It was a function in serving others by telling them. So the same crown or the same imperishable wreath that Paul talks about here is an imperishable wreath that he encourages everyone who is a Christian to pursue, not as an extra reward, but because God has given that to you in Christ when you have accepted that responsibility to be redeemed. So even though some people title this the rights of an apostle and then the whole chapter, in my opinion, that and a dollar will get you a drink in a drink machine unless they've gone up. It's not about having extraordinary rights and privileges over and above other Christians. It's about every one of us as Christians persevering to that reward of being in God's presence because God gave us that ability in accepting Christ and accepting us through Christ. Another passage that sometimes speaks of crowns is found in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Verses 19 and 20. Now, starting in verse 17, Paul writes to the Thessalonian Christians about wanting to come and visit with them again. And he says, as for us, brothers and sisters, when for a short time we were made orphans by being separated from you, in person though not in heart, we longed with great eagerness to see you face to face. For we wanted to come to you, certainly I, Paul, wanted to again and again, but Satan blocked our way. For what is our hope or joy or crown of boasting before our Lord Jesus Christ at His coming? Is it not you? Yes, you are our glory and joy. Here's another passage where he talks about a crown of boasting or a crown of victory. But notice, here, Paul is not talking about having a crown that he can wave and say, hey, look what I got and you didn't get it. Not an extra special thing for he as an apostle. Paul says that you, my fellow Christians, with whom I have lived and with whom I have taught, with whom I have shared this gospel, you are the crown. Not something else out there, but our fellowship together is the crown. That is the reward. And what he is also saying to them is that each one of them is the crown or the reward of another one. And even Paul is the crown of one of them, as everything is shared together. So once again, this is one of those places where, though some people, I mean, I know there are all kinds of interpretations out there, but some people would use this passage talking about winning crowns and extra stars in the crown. You know, how many folks have you saved? Or how many folks have you got saved? I've heard that question so many times over the years. We don't save anybody. It's God that saves. We're the ones who share and have shared with us. So it's not that this passage is not about Paul getting something that other folks don't get. This passage is about all of them sharing and being the glory and the joy for each other. Now, sometimes we don't act like glory and joy. Well, I knew a joy one time was kind of snobby, but sorry. But sometimes we don't act like we're glory and joy for folks. And sometimes we might not think of somebody as really bringing us much glory or joy. But as Christians, that is part of our attire, our crown, is others with whom we share in that Christian life. Moving further along, if we were to look at 2 Timothy. Wait a minute, went the wrong way. Chapter 4. Starting in verse 6. Once again, the author here talks about his circumstances in which he finds himself, and once again he mentions this idea of gaining a crown. As for me, I am already being poured out as a libation, and the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. A lot of y'all can complete this passage. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. From now on, there is reserved for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have longed for His appearing. Paul, or whoever is authoring here, there's some question as to the author, but Paul, or whoever is the author here, is looking back upon his life near the time of his death and is reflecting upon that and reflecting upon how sometimes life has been a struggle and he's had to fight to maintain faith. I know none of us have ever had to fight to maintain our faith or struggle to maintain our faith, right? But he's had to struggle and fight to maintain his faith. And even through all of that, he has worked hard and he has done good and his faith has sustained him. It has allowed him to get to the end of his life and to know that because of that connection he has had with God and with others, and because he has continued, even in the difficult times, to struggle and to still find a way through with faith, that he is going to get that righteousness, that crown of righteousness. Well, what is that? People talk about all kinds of things. But it's really his life is crowned with a right relationship with God. Righteousness means to have a right relationship. And his life has been crowned with that, but notice what else he says in answer to our question here. He doesn't say, I'm going to get that crown, and boy, I'm going to boast about it, and y'all are going to be envious when you get there. He says, I'm going to get that crown of righteousness which the righteous judge, my wife says, if I do that when I talk too fast, which the righteous judge, Jesus himself, is going to give to me and to all. To all who have longed for his appearing. In other words, to everyone who perseveres throughout, even though they may struggle in their faith sometimes. So it is not for just Paul. It is for every person who is a Christian and perseveres to the end. James, chapter 1. Paul wasn't the only one that knew something about difficulties and struggling with faith. The author of James knows something about that as well. And in his sermon that is in the form of a letter here, in verse 12, he says, "Blessed is anyone who endures temptation. Such a one has stood the test and will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him." The crown of life. Those who face temptation, who face trials, who face difficult decisions in life, but continue to persevere by seeking God, even in those. And even sometimes when we seek God, we still make the wrong choice. Well, some of us do anyway. But those who face trial, who face temptations, and who stand the test, persevering with God, will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love Him. And what is that crown? It is everlasting life that was promised to us, not because we checked off this list of things we had to do, but because we accepted God's invitation, God accepted us in Christ, and we continued to live by that standard as best we could with God's help and the help of others. And it's not just for James. It's also for Dolly. It's also for Martha. It's also for each and every one of us if we persevere. If we persevere. In fact, if there is anything in the letter of James that should serve, that is especially said, and we who are teachers or preachers or whatever in positions, vocational positions like that, should pay attention to, it's in James chapter 3, verse 1, in my opinion. And once again, this doesn't have to do with the crown of life. And a dollar gets you drinking a drink machine. "Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and sisters, for you know that we who teach will be judged with a greater strictness." I think of that verse an awful lot. That's why I work as hard as I do at what I do. And even then, sometimes I'm not too sure. Part of our persevering, especially we who are in vocational ministry positions, or we who are Sunday school teachers, or we who are WMU teachers and directors and RAs and GAs and other things, is we have to be very careful to make sure that we do the very best that we can in sharing with others and in sharing in that crown of life. Because James says, God's going to look at us and say, you know, you had the ability, you had the knowledge, you had the opportunity. What'd you do with it? It's so if there's anything that James says to us as we who maybe are vocational ministers or others who take on the responsibilities of teaching and doing things like that, leading in other ways, we need to be careful. For you know that we who teach will be judged with a greater strictness. Therefore, we really should not be arrogant about crowns of life or anything else. However, I must say that there is one passage in the New Testament that seems to, and this is where most people who say the pastor is going to get a special crown of glory. So we don't want to tempt him with other things. Now, a special crown of glory would be found in 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. In particular, verses 1 through 5. And this is the one that is most often used by those who say the pastor is going to get an extra dispensation. Now, as an elder myself and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as one who shares in the glory to be revealed, I exhort the elders among you to tend the flock of God that is in your charge, exercising the oversight not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you do it, not for sordid gain, but eagerly. Do not lord it over those in your charge, but be examples to the flock. I wonder if folks teaching in seminaries these days have ever read that. No. Excuse me. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will win the crown of glory that never fades away. In the same way, you who are younger must accept the authority of the elders, and all of you must clothe yourselves with humility in your dealings with one another, for God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. That one verse, verse 4, is the one that if people are going to use a scriptural verse to talk about pastors, that's the elder here. There were different elders in the church. There were ruling elders and teaching elders. The teaching elder eventually evolves into what is the role of the pastor, who is in charge of both spiritual and some temporal matters. Ruling elders, which Presbyterian Church still has, teaching elders and ruling elders. Ruling elders were those who oversaw the temporal affairs of the church, the building, the grounds, the money, that kind of thing. And so here, the author is talking about, I'm an elder. I understand all this stuff. And I'm saying to you who are elders that you're to tend the flock. And here in verse 4, he does say, and when the chief shepherd, that is, Christ, appears, you will win the crown of glory that never fades away. Literally in the Greek, you could also translate it, you will receive payment that will never fade away. But it does talk about the crown here as well. However, I think we have to look at that verse in context. The context here is the context of one who tends the flock, who cares for the church, and who cares for even those outside of the church with whom he or she comes into contact. Not lording over them, but being examples to the flock. Not using authority, but being examples of service, of study, of teaching, of sharing in the faith with each other. However, I do not think, because he mentions here, if we continue to read, in the same way you who are younger accept the authority of the elders, and all of you must clothe yourselves with humility in your dealings with one another. For God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that He may exalt you in due time. And then that verse that so many people love, cast all your anxieties or all your cares on Him, because He cares for you. The context here is not that the pastor or the elder wags his finger and gives them what for and says it's my way or the highway. But rather, in humility, all Christians are to serve. And I do not think that this crown of glory that never fades away is an extra special dispensation. I think that is merely the crown of glory that we as Christians receive when we persevere to the end, doing what God calls us to do, whether it is as a vocational minister, as a missionary, as an auto mechanic, as an engineer, even those that wear the little hat, or in any other way that we relate to others in the world. In humility, dealing with grace, dealing with tenderness, then that crown, which is everlasting life in God's presence through Christ, is present for any who persevere. So, you may disagree, and that's okay, but the crown of glory is a special reward for the faithful, obedient, God-called pastor. No, it's not a biblically sound statement. It's the same thing that every other church member, and by the way, the pastor is a member of the church too. It's, in my opinion, it is exactly the same reward, or the, not reward, it's the same byproduct of our Christian living that we have been promised when not only we accepted God in Christ, but when God accepted us in Christ. So, that's all I got to say about that. For us. Now, anyone care to add? You can disagree. That's okay. We don't have to agree. Any follow-up questions? Any follow-up comments? Yeah, we do expect compensation as humans. Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think that we, you know, we do have all of that that whole thing. We want to know it's there, even though don't lay up treasures for yourselves on earth, but lay them up in heaven, and all of that, as you mentioned a moment ago. You know, that all sounds good, but it's, you know, Christian life's never been promised to be easy. And it sounds good and it sounds easy, but then it proves not to be easy because of our limited human nature. I think you're right, Ken. The carrot works a whole lot better than the stick sometimes, but then again, sometimes the stick works better than the carrot. That's why, you know, there were people when Jonathan Edwards would preach his, and he preached it more than once, his fiery sermon, Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God, he would get all kinds of crowds, and eventually that and some of the other ministers that would follow suit, follow him as an example, and then start preaching all these things about terrible punishments for those going to hell and everything. Eventually folks figured out the drawing card wasn't so that people would come and walk the aisle. I mean, people didn't come to walk the aisle. They came because of their insatiable human curiosity about, well, you know, those who were really good will get all these rewards, but let's hear about what all these bad things are going to happen to all these bad people. And so some of them started backing off on the rhetoric. But it's the same thing with the carrot. You know, we promise the reward. If you're good, I'm going to give you a piece of candy. You know, if you'll be quiet while we go through the grocery store and you don't ask for this or ask for that, then we'll buy you something at the checkout. Yeah. We do. Either that or they have done something wrong and they're getting what they deserve. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, because we're always trying to figure out the mind of God to stay one step ahead of destruction and, quite frankly, one step ahead of our neighbor too. One of the things in this rather tongue-in-cheek book, you know, Keeping Up with the Episcopal Joneses, is one of his articles in here. As I said, he wrote it for Episcopalians because he was one. But you know how people try to keep up with or one step ahead of the next-door neighbor, because then the next-door neighbor thinks, well, boy, they must really be doing something good. That was a problem in Jesus' day with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Sadducees, in particular, were the wealthy, aristocratic landowners and businessmen, etc. And they did not, where the Pharisees believed that eventually there would be, not only was there the immortality of the soul, but there would be a physical bodily resurrection and people would be rewarded or punished in the afterlife. The Sadducees believed in the immortality of the soul, but there was no reward or punishment in the afterlife because the only thing there was Sheol, where everybody went and spent eternity. And therefore, punishments and rewards came in this life. And in the way they looked at it, they said this: if you are wealthy, if you have power, if you have position, and you have good health, then obviously you have been keeping the law and God is rewarding you in this life. If you are poor, have no power, are sickly, then obviously you have broken the law and God is punishing you in this life. And some of them would even go so far as to, you know, if they loaned money, if their business was loan sharking, and they'd charge all of these exorbitant interest rates and the poor folks couldn't pay, they would, in their own minds, say, "Ah, well, see, I must really be doing well because God is allowing me to make more money and is using me to help punish these other people over here." But who is it that's saying that? The guys who have the money and the power and the control and all of that kind of stuff. And so a lot of times we as humans, we look for that because we want to think there's got to be something extra special out there, especially if we run into difficulties in life. We think, well, there's got to be something extra special out there because obviously I'm not getting it here. And the extra special out there is available to us here, in the way we live our lives and experience, even in the difficult times. But as you say, in our finitude and our human nature, with which we have the opportunity to choose, oftentimes we do fail at that, and we want to see something else out here. I by no means am I one of those that's immune to that kind of stuff. But, you know, we do it all the time to try and it's especially done with, it used to be done on the old sawdust trail. If you couldn't scare them in, you promised them this stuff. And if you couldn't get them in, promise them this extra stuff, you tried to scare them in. And yet, I think it's a lot easier said than done. I admit it's a whole lot easier to say the crown of life, the crown of righteousness, the crown of glory that we receive is not an extra reward out there. That's what's been promised to us and given to us right from the get-go. And we should not be ministering to folks and telling other folks about Christ and sharing our lives with them to get an extra reward. We should be doing that because we really don't deserve it to begin with, and God's giving it to us. It's real easy to say. It's a whole lot harder to live. At least for me it is. So I think you're right. You know, we do that, and that's part of our human predicament. Sometimes I wish I had all the answers. Sometimes I wish that, that God had made things a little more cut and dried. But as I've said often, and many of you know, the longer I live, the more gray the world and life becomes. And not just the gray in my head, but those areas. But thanks, Ken. Anyone else? Right. Yeah, you're right. I think you're right. You know, we run into those situations like that, and we end up chastising ourselves. And a part of that is the conscience that God has given to us. The Spirit acts in that conscience that says, but you know, it's not that we're after an extra reward. It's that we're trying to get to where we're supposed to be. It does. Yes, it does. It does. Thank you, Dolly. Should you turn in that good conduct medal? Have you still got the mold that you made it from? No, I don't think you should. Yeah. No, I don't think you ought to turn in your good conduct medal for the Army. I think they probably should have taken your driver's license, but when you were driving over there, at the wrong beach. Sorry, I was
the tank driver.
Yeah, I know. Nah, okay. Others. Okay. That's right. Yeah. Right. The goal, Anne was sharing that in when people talk about the crown, that in Revelation chapter 4, where it talks about the 24 elders and how they took the crowns that they had and cast them at the Lord's feet and said, He's the only one that's worthy of the crown, not we. And you know, you run into those kinds of things. Anyway, I was reading the question for next time. I think, you know, we have to look at all. Of course, I hear people when we talk about, there's going to be the millennium, there's going to be the rapture, and we're going to be taken out ahead of time, and all this kind of stuff based on the particular passage in Revelation. But as we've read before, if you look at that particular passage in Revelation, the ones that are taken out ahead of time are the ones that have been the martyrs who have been beheaded. They kind of miss that when they read it, you know. But the martyrs that have been beheaded. Question? Comment? Okay. Huh. They wrote sideways. If you knew someone was a born-again Christian, and they said to you, I used to believe once saved, always saved, but I don't feel that way anymore, how would you approach that statement? Thank you. We've talked in the past some about once saved, always saved, but I guess next week we'll deal with that a little bit more. How would you respond to someone? A born-again Christian who says, I used to believe once saved, always saved, but I don't feel that way anymore. Okay. We'll talk about that next Sunday evening. Talk about what it means to be saved, redeemed, that kind of stuff. Anything else before we go this evening? I do appreciate you all coming, spending this time together, because indeed we are in this together. And as you go, know this: there is a crown of righteousness, there's a crown of life, there is a crown of glory. But it's not something that's given extra special for somebody because they have found a call to a particular vocational task. It is the life and the glory and the righteousness that God offers to each and every one of us through Christ. We who accept it and we who persevere in the good times, the bad times, and the mundane times. For it is in that we truly find life. And that is the crown. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.